The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to our AEW Dynasty Review. It's John Pollock and Wei Ting coming at you Sunday night / Monday morning. How are you, Wei?
I'm doing all right. Yeah, it's Monday morning. It is officially.
It is officially Monday morning as we go live here and speak to all of you that are joining us after tonight's big Dynasty pay-per-view.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's sort of the norm, right? You know, a midnight end time for these pay-per-views.
Yes, we have a lot to discuss from this this particular show. We're going to mention off the bat, it's a super late show, so we are not going to be doing calls tonight. We will go to feedback on the forum, so if you do want to leave feedback there, you will. But we're going to try and keep this to a concise hour for the sake of myself and Wei, who have been we did have a very busy morning. But here we are. I have a lot of energy. I will say that. I thought I was going to be exhausted by this point, but I am not, because I thought that show was excellent, just getting my my cards on the table at the beginning.
Yeah, definitely. Certainly helps, you know, when a show is good. But, I mean, as John mentioned earlier today, we did our CN Tower climb. So off the top, I wanted to thank everybody who contributed to our fundraiser for the World Wildlife Fund. We set a very lofty goal at the beginning of last week for $3,000. And I'm very happy to announce that we've actually surpassed it today. $3,025 raised of our $3,000 goal for the World Wildlife Fund. So it made every single one of those 1,776 steps that much more worthwhile, I'll say.
Were you happy with your performance, Wei?
Yeah, I'd say so. Came in at a better time than last year, which was my goal, you know, under 20 minutes. How can I not be happy with that?
Yeah, you were quite the machine.
I mean, as were you. We pretty much at the same time.
We were very close. We were within 15, 20 seconds of each other.
Yeah. Davey was way out front, though.
Davey, like, really, he sets the pace.
1652 Davey Portman. So the man is quite the machine. But also joining us, Braden Harrington, Jesse from the Six, Samuel Jackson himself.
The Samuel L. Jackson joining
That's
us.
That's right. Yeah. So thank you for the
Where's our seventh member that was also part of our team?
That guy?
R-Truth.
Yeah. This gentleman right here who just decided to photobomb our group shots. I'd love to know his identity. I would more than invite him to join us again next year.
Yeah. Well, we had a fun time. I was very happy with myself at the end of it all. It was a good, fun morning, I thought. Mm-hmm. So. Mm-hmm. Anyway, maybe we'll talk a bit about that tomorrow, but we're going to dive into Dynasty tonight from the Chaffetz Arena. WrestleTick's last update was 6,544, which, I mean, they were promoting it as a sellout on the broadcast, and they were not shy about sellout that they were promoting throughout the night. So we will probably get a final number in the next day or two. But we go back to the 0 hour, which almost needs to be rebranded now to the 0 hour and a half.
I guess so. The wrestling does start, though, at the hour mark.
That's true. We get 30 minutes of Rene Paquette and RJ City, and kicking things off with St. Louis's own Matt Sydal, with Brother Mike in his corner taking on the now heel Trent Beretta. The crowd was chanting for Sue at one point, and some highlights of this match. They did give Sydal like a fair amount of offense here. He hit a Meteora, but Trent kicked out of that, hit a Gotch pile driver onto Sydal, and I was thinking maybe they're going to give this as his new finisher, but that was only for a two count. And then Trent hits the flying knee, which obviously that's what he used to turn on Cassidy with, but thinking that was going to be a finish, no, he does have a new move in his arsenal, applying a go-go plata in 8 minutes and 10 seconds, and will not release the hold until referee Mike Posey is getting involved, and then Chuck Taylor gets into the ring, sliding in, and Trent says he's been trying to contact Chuck Taylor. He's giving him until Wednesday to declare his allegiance. Who are you with? So where are the best friends going to lie? Will they be in on the same side or in opposing forces?
Mm-hmm. I'm guessing Chuck joins him because otherwise I mean there's some potential in a best friends feud, but I feel like it's better for Chuck's character to also turn heel. But it was a good match, solid in ring here. Good to see Trent like be able to fully lean into a more aggressive heel role. I thought he did really well. I love like using a turn to introduce a new finisher, and something like the Go-Go Plata is it was surprisingly not used really significantly in professional wrestling since The Undertaker. And I think there's like a real sort of like heelishness to the move that I think will work for him.
And then, so we had the post-match, and I liked what they did here. So Trent is going up the ramp, and then Orange Cassidy's music plays because he's in the next match. So you have this standoff between Orange Cassidy and Trent Barretta, and you think, like, maybe they're going to come to blows, but then Shibata comes out, and that's enough to send Trent flying to the back. And just, like, a nice transition there from one match to the next, and keeping that the focus with Trent and Orange that you would think they can hold off until the next pay-per-view. That would be a logical time to pull off that one.
Mm-hmm.
So it's Cassidy and Shibata against Shane Taylor and Lee Moriarty with Anthony Ogogo on commentary. So we went from the Go-Go Plata to Ogogo on commentary. I mean, if there's anyone that should be, I know he's the boxer, but if he ever learned jiu-jitsu, I mean, what a finisher.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yes, yes.
Shibata and Taylor are trading blows, and then Cassidy's in with his casual elbow off the top. And then Ogogo steps up behind Orange Cassidy, but gets stopped by Shibata with these big uppercuts. And there's jabs chopped by Shibata and Cassidy mixing in the weak shots, but then they increase in intensity and they're working together. And after a package pile driver is attempted to Orange Cassidy, it's stopped with a choke from Shibata, and then Shibata boots Ogogo off the apron, PK to Taylor, and then we see Lee landing the flying knee, and it finishes with Cassidy and Lee trading covers, ending with the orange punch in 12 minutes and 47 seconds as Cassidy and Shibata win.
I thought a very good match here. You know, Cassidy's like lazy shtick is able to come out a little bit more because it plays so well in contrast to like Shibata's ultra serious and straightforward in-ring style. So I think just even comedically, they're a very good team. To me, maybe a little bit too much like involvement from Anthony Ogogo here without referee intervention throughout the end of this match. But overall, I enjoyed it.
It wasn't a Continental Classic title match, so I mean, free reign,
right?
I guess
perfectly legal, yes.
Mm-hmm. Totally. And then the final match on the 0 Hour was the Acclaimed and Daddy Ass against the Bang Bang Gang for the AEW Trios and ROH six-man tag titles. Max Caster comes out for an extended rap about hitting them with a circumcision. Jay White is an opening act in the U.S., which I found to be kind of like you're kind of burying yourself that you guys are on the pre-show. Like, you're working with the opening act. So that makes you the opening act too, right?
I mean, I suppose so. Although it is hitting on, I think, a point of criticism for Jay White, where maybe you could say expectations were certainly a lot higher than what his current status is.
They're going to send him back to Cora Q and Hall, and you choke on the mic. You can choke on my nuts. And he says, then the music ends. And so he continues with like part two of the rap. I guess he was inspired this week.
Yeah.
Says that Jay White needs,
freestyle.
I guess he needs a beard because he has a kid's face. Looks like you hang outside the sixth grade and your hype is all fake, like the Trump piss tape, which, I mean, my God, we're talking about like years ago in terms of that reference. Like, he's much more timely, it seems. But anyway, says he's going to violate him so badly he'll need to tell the legal team the taste of his. And then Bowens grabs the microphone to end this rap.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe a little bit unusual to have Caster kind of do this like extra acapella bit, but maybe they felt it was necessary just given I would say
the prominence of this being a unification match that it needs the extended rap.
I mean that, but also I would say like over the past year, it feels like the significance of his raps have certainly declined, you know, and much of that, I think maybe in storyline chalked up to the association with the Bullet Club as well. So maybe they felt a need to redeem himself, I guess, this many months later.
So I'm glad this match finished the way it did because, I mean, you watch these matches involving Billy Gunn, and it's like, dude, the match is built around Billy Gunn as like the heavy for the team. Like, everything builds to his hot tags. He's like, he's the enforcer of the group. It would be like if you were just blind listening to this on the you would assume like Billy Gunn is the next big star that's going to break out of this pack of trios, like the way you're watching this 60-year-old, and he's just treated like Superman here.
I think there's a lot of like there's a lot of like portraying Billy as that character simply due to his size. Like, he is the biggest member of the group, but the fact that he's 60, I think, kind of like makes that irrelevant.
But the fact that he's 60,
like, no, it's ridiculous. And I mean, I suppose you can
argue. All I'm going to say is when Rock and Hogan had their match at WrestleMania, Hogan, I believe, was 12 years younger than Billy Gunn.
Oh, goodness. I suppose if you are going to look at like who of the three would be taking the hot tag, maybe there's an argument for Billy Gunn, you know, just kind of being the most popular member of the group to do it. But the fact that he's 60, I totally agree. I think it's a bit of an awkward fit.
The announcers brought up, remember, the Guns and Jay White broke into Billy Gunn's house. I'm like, oh, yeah, I have completely forgotten about that. How we got here. The only memory I have is that dreadful singles match that will live in my brain for the rest of this year. Colton goes to hug Billy, but then Billy just drills him with a punch. They hit the scissor me timbers onto Austin, and then Caster misses in the corner and just looks clumsy here, flying to the floor. And then we see Billy call for the Famouser onto his son Colton, but before hitting the Famouser, he yells at his son, "Suck this!" And the announcers are just like, what is he yelling at his own son? And Austin gets involved, allowing Colton to hit a Famouser on his dad, but dad ain't staying down for the Famouser. So then Billy stops the 310 to Yuma. White then hits Gunn with the bat, then a 310 to Yuma. So he's hit with a baseball bat and the 310 to Yuma. That's got to put Billy Gunn down, right? No, he kicks out to the big pop. It's like this guy, it's the main event of WrestleMania starring Billy Gunn. So then he hits the Famouser. Mic drop follows by Caster. White gets to kick out. And we end with a sequence between Gunn and Jay White where both men counter the other's finisher before the Blade Runner is hit and Jay White pins the nearly unstoppable Billy Gunn in 14 minutes and 45 seconds.
Well, if you recall, like, Sting kind of was portrayed in a very similar fashion, you know, where he was like sort of like the big, almost like mythical member of the team, right?
So, how many people is Billy Gunn going to draw at the Greensboro Coliseum for his retirement?
Well, match? All I'm saying is, I think in the AEW universe, as you get older, you become that much more powerful and athletic and tough to defeat.
Oh. Okay.
You age upwards, or
I understand
differently.
Yeah. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I thought the match itself, I thought, was okay. Like, nothing really wrong with it, but nothing also really stood out to me. Crowd was very reactive for the Acclaim. They were reactive for the title change. Personally, I just, because I haven't really been captivated by the feud nor any of the matches that preceded this, I didn't feel very invested in the result either way.
I thought this was one of the weaker matches on the show. I'm glad they're unifying the tag titles. I think that both sides have kind of been cooled off by working with the others. I have not enjoyed this feud post split, and I'm happy to see the Bang Bang Gang was the team I think you should put these trios belts on, and you can go on your merry way. I think the Acclaimed and Daddy Ass, they can, like, they're a fun act, but this program has not done it for me in the least.
The future is a hefty responsibility, and not one that we take lightly. But then, taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Jim Ross comes out for the first pay-per-view match, and kicking off the pay-per-view is Kazuchika Okada and Pac for the Continental Championship. And they did a Megan O'Leary-style preview for the match with Renee next to the ramp teeing up the match. And they only did it for this one match, but again, they're also experimenting with a lot of production changes and such like that. But I like this.
They've done this in the past, too.
They have before, yeah. So the crowd is going nuts right when the match starts. So it was a lively crowd, and that would be the case for most of this show. And we get the note that Okada is living in New York City.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I guess if you're making that sort of money, you could live anywhere in the U.S. I mean, why wouldn't you pick New York City?
So Okada lands his beautiful drop kick that Jim Ross calls That's five stars or whatever you want to call it. Five-star dropkick. And then there's a draping DDT to Pack off the barricade. He beats the count in at nine. Pack hit this amazing top rope acai moonsault to the floor. And someone posted this in slow motion after. It looked incredible. The two are trading German suplexes. And then we get Okada landing the elbow drop. And my favorite spot, he's just milking the crowd for the pose. And they're all like, that's like his babyface spot. No matter what role he's playing, they're going to pop for the pose. And the crowd's like getting so excited for it. And instead of putting the arms out, he gives the middle finger. Amazing heat here. Excellent. And they chant, fuck Okada, at him. Just tremendous here. And then Okada gets lifted up for this bridging German. And if you go back, his facial expression was amazing here. You would think this man was being thrown off a building. Kicks out of that. Pac misses the black arrow and Okada hits a tombstone. From there, we get a belly to back that's countered to the brutalizer. And then Okada gouges the eyes to break free. And then after another tombstone, climbs to the top. But Okada grabs Paul Turner's leg to delay. Finally, Pac gets him back into position, goes for the black arrow, lands on the knees, and that leads to the Rainmaker, and Okada pins him in 21 minutes and 55 seconds. Really hot opener, I thought.
I thought so, too. I think there was probably at least a little bit of extra significance riding on this simply because it was Okada's first proper AEW pay-per-view match, like not as a contracted, you know, New Japan performer. And I don't think it could have gone better. You know, Okada is somebody that, you know, we can now kind of see every single week on TV, but he's still perhaps known best as maybe one of the best, if not the best 20 plus minute match worker of the past decade. So his greatest value to this company was always going to be as a special attraction for a pay-per-view. And this match needed to feel that much more significant compared to a regular AEW Dynamite appearance for Okada. And they needed to establish that Okada matches are something that's worth paying for. And beyond that, specific to AEW, this needed to feel like the level of dream match that you can only get in AEW. And I thought it satisfied all of those things, you know, beyond just being a great in-ring match that was really well paced, not suffering from any of the long sort of like drawn out template of like you know, the Okada babyface New Japan style that I personally grown so tired of. I thought this match did a great job of showcasing Okada's great understanding of what it means to be a professional wrestling heel, playing towards a North American crowd. You know, he feels very like I would say kind of advanced, you know, in his ability to play with the crowd, his facial expressions, his selling as he's like, you know, being lifted for like a German suplex, for instance. So it just kind of makes you wonder why New Japan like never really fully committed to this heel run for Okada that much earlier. But both men to me felt very special, including Pac, of course.
Yeah. And I mean, when you're looking up and down this card, I mean, if there was as much of a guaranteed outcome, it was this one with Okada, and that did not hinder the audience's belief in Pac. And I think just the fact that this opened the show, people treated this like a big deal. The fact that they've had some tags going back way, way back into the 2000s, but never a singles match before. So, I mean, this was, you know, a very, I was looking for of this loaded card. This was one that jumped out to me that I was looking forward to.
Yeah. So maybe not on the level of like Danielson Ospreay, but still Pac versus Okada hit like that sort of dream match status for a lot of people. And
when the bell rung, they were treating it like the you were getting like the holy shit chant right at the beginning of this one.
Two men who, you know, I think on their own have built up like incredible reputations that have never had this sort of like one-on-one substantial meeting before. And that's like the type of booking that Okada matches need to have. Like that's the type of feeling you need to have for the rest of Okada's matches, at least this year on pay-per-view. And again, that to me is the value. Like it greatly elevated Pac simply being in this position, because we've seen a lot of Pac matches, but this to me was like Pac feeling his most special because of the dream match status of this match.
And after Okada left, they did the Pac spot in the ring where he was left alone. The crowd gave him a standing ovation and chanted, "He's our bastard." So going the extra mile here to at least give some focus to Pac coming out of this match too. Adam Copeland, Eddie Kingston, and Mark Briscoe against the House of Black. Malachi is tagged in with Copeland and teases going at it with him, but then he immediately tags out to Brody King. So King and Kingston traded big chops. Kingston delivering the machine gun chops in the corner. All six end up on the floor, and Matthews grabs a chair, tosses it at Mark Briscoe, who catches it, and then places it on the edge, and Mark runs across the apron, leaps off the chair, and flips over the post, landing on King on the floor. And it was Schiavone who noted, man, that chair could have slid. And yeah, that would have been disastrous, but I mean, nailed it here.
There's actually like quite a bit of space like on the aprons here, you know, in this AEW ring. So, I mean, I'm sure I would trip on it. You know, any regular human wouldn't think about doing this, but you can fit like an extended chair on it, is, you know.
King then catches Briscoe off the apron and hits a DVD into the barricade. Copeland then scales to the top for a superplex onto Brody King. All six men are down, and we see a sequence of an Hurricane Impaler DDT and the Froggy Bow onto King, but Buddy Matthews runs in, making the save, and then that is when House of Black fire up, and they charge at the babyfaces, but are met with three spears simultaneously. Copeland is setting up for one more on Malachi Black, but as he charges at Malachi, he is hit with the dreaded Black Mist, and then is hit with the spin kick, which they are calling the end, and pins Adam Copeland in 17 minutes and 47 seconds. I love this finish at the end, you know, of... Like, I like the idea of, you know, Adam Copeland loses here, and they've been very, very protective of Copeland. It sets up your obvious match with Malachi, and probably you could splinter off several of these, given we have three champions on one side.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I really enjoyed this match, too. To me, this was the type of match that showcased what your trios championship matches should be. Like, just really fast-paced activity, multi-person, long-chain sequences where, like, each team were kind of acting as their own single entity, and they were almost like each participant was finishing the other's sentences, like that sort of vibe. Great chemistry, I felt, between the babyface team here, you know? Kingston and
Briscoe, they've been great just in the handful of matches they've had in the lead-up. Like, the match with Top Flight and Action Andretti on Collision, like... I really hope that these three have this alliance.
I think so, too.
Going forward.
Yeah, like, obviously Kingston and Briscoe already have that history. But, like, I'm actually very surprised at how well Copeland fits in with them. Like, and maybe part of that is just because they're all very sincere, like, likable baby faces. But I think there's a lot more story potential to be mined from, like, this association. In ring, I thought they gelled really well together. And against a team as cohesive and almost as, like, perfectly formed at this point as the House of Black, I thought these were, like, excellent babyface opponents. I think there were moments in this match where, like, you know, the showdown between Malachi and Copeland, I expect might have, like, they might have intended on those reactions being a lot bigger, just these two kind of staring each other down. And it's not really there yet, but maybe coming off of this finish and maybe with more storytelling, it will get there. But hopefully by the time they do that singles match, it'll feel that much bigger.
Julia Hart against Willow Nightingale for the TBS Championship. We have... So Willow comes out with Chris Statlander, and then it's announced that Chris Statlander and Sky Blue are banned from ringside because this is house rules. And the way it was played was that Willow's made this choice, and Chris Statlander is finding out in the moment that Willow doesn't need her there. So I think that's definitely planting something.
Like, who's the asshole there? You know, Willow for, like, I think
Willow wants to do this on her own.
Yeah, but why wouldn't she tell Chris Statlander in the back? You know,
you would definitely give someone a heads up. Like, why am I here? Why am I? Would you not tell them at Gorilla, like, as they're coming out? Like, boy, are you in for a surprise? You're going to look like a fool on pay-per-view.
I'd probably tell them before they got on the flight to get all the way here.
Well, we know everyone flies to every wrestling show, and you're just there. Right, as permanent fixtures. Yeah. So she is sent to the back, and she's looking disappointed, but gives Willow a hug. And I thought for sure Statlander was coming back for something, but was not the case. Willow's family was in the front row. That was my second. Okay, so we're teasing a heel turn, and the family's there. Not a chance she's winning. Not in this company. Hathaway is on commentary.
It's not 2023, okay?
I know. It's not 2023. It's a new year. Now it's a good luck to bring your family. Willow starts very aggressively, but then is kicked off the turnbuckle, landing on the floor, and we see Mercedes Moné backstage as well.
She's getting the winner.
She's banned from ringside, I guess, as well. Julia Hart kicks out of a sleeper and is hit by a spinebuster, and then Hart drops her in the corner, and the boots come up, climbs for the moonsault. Willow gets her boots up and then just hits the lariat and the babe with the powerbomb and wins in 6 minutes, 2 seconds. Shortest match on the show, And we do get Willow winning the TBS title to set up the match with Mercedes Moné at Double or Nothing. And we came out, did the face off. They got the graphic up. So they were hitting this hard. Like, this will be one of the featured matches next month. And Willow celebrated with her mom and sister that they showed in the front row.
Yeah, there was a bit of a continued tease of Statlander turning on Willow here, with Statlander coming out to the back of Willow. And at that point, like, the crowd were led to anticipate some sort of turn. But she instead just decided to give her a hug. But they're very much laying those pieces there. Let's also remember, Trent and Statlander had a scene in the back as well that kind of at this point is still unresolved. So maybe something going on between those two.
And we have this mystery attacker, too. With Mercedes.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep. So, you know, but the match length itself, it was relatively a straightforward match. You know, I thought they would give Julia at least like one big kick out or something here, but it was like Babe with the powerbomb and, you know, got the win. So maybe when you look at like the length of this card, you can understand maybe why a match like this might have been shortchanged. Overall, I thought it was a fine match, but among the standard of the quality of the show, didn't make that much of an impression on me. But I do think like we can at least at this point say, like, I think Julia Hart had a really good run as TBS champion. She's demonstrated a lot of like maturity as a big character capable of handling this sort of spotlight at such a young age too. So I look forward to seeing what's next for her.
Yeah, she's not that old when you actually look at her age.
She is our standard for grading how old we are. Yes.
Roderick Strong against Kyle O'Reilly was next for the International Championship. I will say this. I did not see the countdown show that I'm assuming most of these video packages were from. There were some excellent video packages building these up, and I just wish some of that could be more incorporated into the show. Like, I'm sorry, when we look at the amount of hours for AEW, I amazingly watched Collision and Rampage today, which, I mean, that Collision show last night, especially that 2-hour block, was amazing. It was such a good show, but there are so many hours to follow of just AEW, much less any other wrestling. The countdown is probably going to fall through the cracks for many people, and it's already the day of the pay-per-view. Most are going to be seeing this, but they had some like great backstory here about their history going back to 2009, each of them having the birth of their children and being, you know, just side by side throughout their entire careers. And Kyle was going to stay away from the international title, but then Roddy saw me as a threat, and now they're having this showdown. So this felt like some 3-month culmination of something that's been a lot less.
Yeah. So I understand, like, at this point, 5 years in, like, it's just not Tony's philosophy to air long video packages on his shows. If anything, they're like 60-second video packages. He favors in-ring content, and maybe he's got, you know, enough statistics to prove that that's a worthwhile philosophy. But I think so many of these story beats should be incorporated in a more prominent fashion, even in your talking segments or backstage interview segments or just, I don't know, commentary spots, you know?
Like sometimes it is a sacrifice to just bring people up to speed, because one of the dominant talking points out there is that, well, these are great matches, but there's no story. I'm like, there are stories attached up and down these cards. They all have stories attached to them. Mm-hmm. It's just, I think sometimes you have an audience that is conditioned to, you know, the WWE style of constant hitting you over the head so you know every last detail. And here it's just
kind of the opposite. You know, you kind of have to go out of your way to watch a video package like this in order to maybe.
But it's the stories are there for you to find. And it's finding a middle. Like, I don't think you need to be feeding your audience like pablum. But I think like there is something when the work you're putting into these video packages. I mean, you just want enough of your audience to kind of have at their disposal. So anyway. The match begins, and Kyle gets slammed off the turnbuckle, and we got into pretty much Roderick Strong going after Kyle's back and just coming up with all these variations of the backbreaker. And Kyle O'Reilly, his strikes here in particular, like the Muay Thai style offense, and then you get into this already, like his submission, like his jiu-jitsu and transferring it to pro wrestling.
I think it's some of the best in professional
wrestling. It's amazing. Yeah. It's amazing. And now, like, you're adding all these other disciplines, too. And, like, this guy is so underrated when it comes, like, watching that. This was by far his best performance since his comeback.
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, it's the longest and most substantial.
He hasn't had, like, that really balls-out match yet until this one. And I thought this match was just spectacular.
But
it's probably not going to be the one everyone's raving about by the end of this show, but I just thought this was an incredible match.
Yeah, but I'll say, at the very least, I'm pretty confident that, like, Tony Khan recognizes that within Kyle O'Reilly, because, like, he kind of just came in kind of cold as a character, but, like, immediately gets this, like, title shot on TV, so...
And gave these two, like, 17 minutes, so it wasn't as though... Like, this was not one of the big matches on the card, but you knew it was going to deliver, and I would say it over-delivered. They go to this crazy pace of striking. Kyle hits a bombs away knee drop onto Strong's knee, and then they get into a kicking exchange, and there's a knee to the body by O'Reilly, followed by an axe kick, and then Roddy hits the flying knee. Both men go down. And then we see Wardlow come up ringside, and he's warned by Paul Turner, and it's like your alarm bells are going off that we're going to get some screwy finish here. But he really played no factor into the finish. He was just there as like a decoy. And we get Kyle doing the bounce off the rope into the lariat, then a brain buster, and he's fighting for the armbar, but Strong is keeping the hands clasped, but Kyle is fighting and fighting for it, and then Strong lands a drop kick after Kyle tries to lift him up, can't get him up, and the end of Heartache is hit, and Strong retains the title at 17 minutes and 20 seconds. In the post-match, we see Bennett and Taven wheel out Adam Cole, who emerges and rises from the wheelchair, walking down, and the Undisputed Kingdom are in the ring, and it was not subtle at all. Adam Cole, like, staring daggers at Wardlow, pretty much telegraphing they're going to whack this guy at some point. They're going to, I mean, maybe they're going to have to hire the family to get rid of him.
Maybe, yeah. So Wardlow, thanks, John Cena, for bringing this to my attention, but Wardlow at 9 p.m. today tweeted out a photo of a car accident he was involved in. He says,
"Jesus,
the devil's been doing everything to stop me lately. Still hasn't learned he can't. Banged up, but I'm alive. Thank you to those that have reached out. Appreciate you all." And the photo of, I think this was like, an escalator or something, like, you know, getting rammed pretty hard.
Dude's lucky he was okay. I mean, didn't look like he had a scratch on him at the pay-per-view. Man.
Yeah. Yeah, tweeting this like 9 o'clock, like pretty much very close to him actually coming out here. So I don't know if this was meant to like maybe throw off our belief that he would be involved at all, but he did come out here, and I do believe that this was probably a legitimate, you know, car accident. So credit to him.
Maybe this was Adam Cole's plan. He's like, "How did you get here?
Yeah, how did you leave me with the insurance bill for this?" This car rental, maybe
Cole's
that's why
rental.
I'm cool. Yeah,
yeah. This match, though, I love this match. I thought it was so strong on a show that had a lot of strong matches. Amazingly, like, this is not going to be match of the show, but it was a really excellent match. Like the best match on the show so far.
I mean, it depends what you're looking for. I thought the six man was really strong as well. Okada and Pac, I think, to a lot of people.
Yeah, yeah. Okada Pac, I would grade above this one too. Like, this is a pretty strong show. Like, if we were at this point, dude, and this is the pay-per-view, I've got my money's worth. Like, I was pretty good. We got three kick-ass matches in the first four matches.
Yeah, but just maybe speaking about this match a bit more in particular, I these are probably my two favorite Undisputed Era members in terms of like in-ring styles. Both have such distinct in-ring styles and are so technical in their own ways, and this was the type of match that I think they you know, it was kind of conveyed like this was a match between brothers, and they kind of wrestled that way, you know, both knowing each other's offense so well. A hard hitting and technical bout where their styles just kind of meshed wonderfully. I do think a blemish, though, was like all the Wardlow stuff, which was a little confusing to me. Like, it was basically a clean win for Roddy, because even Wardlow coming out didn't necessarily distract him to Kyle to lead to anything directly. So
you got the impression that like he's on the outs with Adam Cole, and that he could screw up. He would screw up here, and Kyle wins the title or something to further that. But it was like he didn't even,
I guess,
have
so.
That. So
I'm also.
It was almost like he was just there as like, "Oh, we're getting a run and finish," and to tease you.
I guess so. Maybe I'm also a little bit disappointed that like this felt like such a clean win for Roddy that I kind of feel like Kyle should have left this with a little bit more. He kind of just, you know, took a relatively clean loss here to Roddy and just kind of faded into the background, not to be associated with any sort of Undisputed Era story coming out of this, which is at this point Cole and Wardlow, which is their main story.
Then it was time for the FTW championship match between Hook and Chris Jericho. And I'm sure people have a lot to say about this match. They note that between his two reigns, Hook has been FTW champion for 595 days. And Jericho is getting pelted with boos. But that is not where this crowd started. They went, first of all, they start off with the fist bump. And the crowd starts chanting, Fozzy sucks. And then we get into the suplexes and you get the sense that are we going to go right back to the Toronto match, which was the drubbing by Hook, and he hits a overhead suplex, then a T-bone, and it's FTW rules. So we can bring in weapons, and they had Jericho bring out a table. We have it's false count anywhere on top of that. And then there's these huge trash can lid shots delivered to Jericho. The third one, he DDTs Hook on top of it, and Jericho takes over at this point. They fight onto the edge of the apron, and Hook hits a T-bone off the apron through a table, and the crowd goes nuts for this. And you're thinking, like, the crowd's kind of, like, half into this match, half out, but then this spot hits, and there's, like, okay, they've got the crowd at this point. But as Jericho gets up and gets back into the ring, it was like this crowd just turns like hard on Jericho, and we get chance of go home, Jericho, go home. And it just felt like they no longer wanted this match. And Jericho is like playing like the insincere mentor to Hook. And it's just this heel character that I don't think is connecting. And this was a match that went way too long that the audience was just tired of throughout the middle of.
So I didn't really feel that way myself. Like, I felt like, so you are suggesting that this was X-Pac heat that Jericho was garnering.
I think there were periods that it was actually effective for the match, but I think it went way too long, and I think there were periods where it was not so much heat for Jericho, it was just exhaustion from this program.
You could be right. Personally, I felt like it ultimately became a positive for the match, whatever this reaction was tonight. It felt organic and it felt unpredictable. The crowd were coming up with like chants like please retire that we've never heard before. Mm-hmm. And it resulted in like, I think, a pretty electric atmosphere in favor of Hook as a babyface beating up Chris Jericho.
I thought they did a great job with Hook, like even in losing here. I mean, you have him duck a Judas effect, and he goes to this knee bar, but then Jericho's goes to the walls, Hook cradles out of that, and then after escaping an attempt at the Red Rum, Jericho says I'm sorry and lands the Judas effect, which Hook kicks out from, and they make a big deal out of this that Moxley's the only one to kick out of this Judas effect. So then he apologizes again and hits a second Judas effect, and you think for sure this is over, and Hook kicks out a second time. So you really can't say that they did not try to make Hook look pretty valiant here in defeat. But then Jericho gets the bat, and you see Hook just on his knees giving him the middle fingers as Taz stands up from the broadcast and just puts down his headset, and the crowd actually gets like amped that he's going to do something physical because they go nuts when they see Taz rise up. But he's just there, he just can't talk, he can't participate in calling this, seeing that his son is about, like, it's the prelude to this guy being hit with a bat, and Jericho wallops him with this baseball bat and wins in 16:35, and Taz goes and he yells at Jericho to get away from him, and Jericho, who is keyed as the learning tree, Chris Jericho wins the FTW title. I think you can transition out of this, but I do think there is a, like, this audience to me is emblematic of this overall feeling that people have had for Jericho in what I will call this Lionheart white zombie era of Chris Jericho with these last couple of months.
And I mean, I feel like it's been going even longer than that, you know?
I mean, there's been ups and downs with Jericho. But I feel at this period, we'll see. I mean, it was not like this crowd was just like on its hands and just completely shitting on the match, but there were periods that it did feel like that.
Yeah, I guess I personally didn't kind of get that reaction. Now, I already see in the chat room a lot of people agreeing that it was go-away heat. To me, that's the big debate about this match. What sort of heat was it? Was it the beneficial kind? Which I'm more likely to actually feel like, you know? Yes, it was like a bit of a... So the match I felt was maybe a little bit messy at times, like, but I found it overall very engaging because of like the big suplexes and table spots, but mainly because of this crowd reaction, which I again felt was very unpredictable and special, because it was so different from your typical heel reaction. Like in essence, this was one of the hotter crowd reactions all night, with Jericho getting up until this point the biggest heat by far. So again, the debate is this good heat or is this bad heat? I think it's dependent on the type of story that they're telling and dependent on the type of benefit that Hook ultimately ends up with. I'm very curious to know what people think.
What do you think is the next chapter of this? Like, does this end with Hook getting this title back? Because I just feel this is somewhat backwards in that, okay, you lay out this match and on its surface, okay, it's like the guy goes down fighting and then he gets beaten by like a bat shot. And it's like, is your emotion to be, I want to see Hook get his win over Jericho? Because a month ago, he not only beat Jericho, he destroyed this guy. It's like, I feel like we already got that that reward that you wanted of Hook getting this big win over Jericho. And it's like, we're going backwards.
Right, yeah. I think it ends with Hook getting some sort of form of comeuppance on him. Whether or not if it's in the form of like winning the FTW title back, which I'm not that interested in seeing.
I kind of hope Jericho like just destroys this belt. Like, yeah, that's the killer to Taz. Is like he just destroys this, and this is the last we see of this belt.
It's a pretty worthless championship, sad to say. So, I hope he retires it. Maybe renames it, like the Learning Tree Championship or something stupid like that. Or just get rid of it altogether. And then I think it should end with a big match where Hook again gets to destroy Jericho.
The fact we got those unifications of the six man titles, it does tell you there's at least some acknowledgement that. Like, look up and down this card about the amount of title matches that we had. Like, it was 90% of the show. I think there's at least the acknowledgement, okay, we have a lot of belts here and some that we could do without.
I'm curious to know, like, if they include any other names or any other figures into this feud, because simply having Jericho on one end opposing Hook, number one, it maybe that alone is enough to turn people off, but I think it's also a missed opportunity to not promote another person in support of Jericho, like a heavy, you know, to back Jericho up that might be able to benefit from a lot of this heat as well. So is this the type of program that people want to see continue if there's going to be benefit for others, or do they just want to see this end completely?
I got the sense that people are ready to move on from this, but I mean, you can take like the reaction. I mean, it was, I think Jericho can certainly take this reaction and channel it into a character. I think you can certainly do that.
I don't see him going away. Like, number one, because I think Tony will interpret this reaction tonight as a positive one. I also think like Jericho is just going to be able to do whatever he wants to do, and I think they probably already.
He's also among, if not the highest paid guys too. Like, it's a pretty tough argument to bench someone or just make that argument that, okay, go away for 3 months and then we'll bring you back fresh. They probably paying a lot of money for this individual.
They probably feel like this program is actually just starting to cook. And again, that's kind of up to, I guess, debate now, it seems. But I also feel like
maybe that's what he'll rename Hook.
Cook, yeah, that'll be the person he brings to oppose Hook. But I'm sure they all also have a story already planned, you know, to end this, and we're just probably in the middle chapters.
Then we move to the AEW Women's Championship match with Timeless, Toni Storm, and Thunder Rosa, which Toni Storm did this amazing promo. I So I complained on Wednesday on Dynamite that they put the lipstick all over her face, and then she was in, they put the black and white filter on, so you really couldn't see the work of Thunder Rosa here. But they did have her backstage cut a promo with the lipstick all over her face, and this promo was just it was great. Like, it was a serious promo, but done in the style of Toni Storm, as serious as a promo can be, that includes the sign off, "Hell is my bedroom, and I make love to my demons every night." But I mean, it was a great, great promo. Very, very good. So Thunder Rosa is out, and she's wearing a lucha mask, but then takes it off, revealing no face paint. So she is wrestling without any hidden identity tonight.
Other than like the ton of like mascara that I guess is on.
Well, beyond that, I mean, it was no hidden identity. I mean, Toni Storm looked like she came out as like a ghost.
Yeah, she had like a white powdered face. Yes.
Mm-hmm. So Thunder Rosa hits a tornillo onto Storm and Luther off the top to the floor. And then she's getting a Mariah May's face, warning her, and hits her with a DVD onto the edge. And we're getting dueling chants for the two women when Storm hits a backstabber. And this begins her attack on the weakened back of Thunder Rosa. Storm hits a sky high and continues working on the back, hitting the lower back with shots. And then Thunder Rosa pops up from a German, hitting her own. May gets onto the apron when Deonna Purrazzo runs down and fights with Mariah May to the back, and also sends Luther running into the steps. There is another German suplex to Thunder Rosa, followed by the hip attack and a Storm Zero, which Thunder Rosa kicks out from. So Toni Storm goes to the Texas Cloverleaf, but Thunder Rosa fights to the rope, and it's Thunder Rosa managing a backstabber and puts on this like Cobra Clutch style submission. And they're trying to explain the submission that, look, it's cutting off the air supply. I was like, this was like the loosest applied choke that you could see. Don't know if this one's one to save in the submission maneuvers, but Toni made it to the rope, and then Bryce is fixing the ring skirt as Toni Storm kicks Thunder Rosa low and hits the Storm Zero in 15 minutes and 9 seconds, retaining the women's title in what I thought was like a really strong match.
Yeah, very strong as well. I thought the match received like a really great reaction throughout, and on a card already this stacked, I think that already says something, you know, to go 15 minutes and receive like a consistent level of energy from the crowd. I think Storm has found a really good balance between displays of the character and delivering the type of substantial in-ring performance we've come to expect both from her and like an AEW championship bout.
This is probably the best example of the marriage of the character within a bell to bell match.
Agreed. And I think it took somebody as like serious in ring like a Thunder Rosa to be able to provide the counterpart to that. So I thought these two just brought like tremendous energy to the match. I think there's more life in this feud, you know, like a match with a stipulation or even like gimmick attached to it, I think would be more than welcome by an audience.
Yeah, this was a really strong match on a show that, I mean, to this point, it was already like a pretty strong pay-per-view, I would state. And now I was just looking at this as like this final 2 hours could be one of the all-time stretches. And we go in. Third from the top is Bryan Danielson against Will Ospreay. Don Callis is on commentary, and just the entrances alone, like, this crowd was buzzing. And I don't say that lightly. Danielson has got stitches on his forehead from this bunkhouse brawl that he had on Saturday night. I cannot believe that I watched this bunkhouse brawl way, and I'm not kidding. There are years in the past, I think that bunkhouse brawl might have been some people's match of the year. That bunkhouse brawl was amazing. It was one of the better TV matches I have seen in a long time, and I'm watching this match, and at the end, and I'm thinking, no one is even going to remember this by Monday, and that's probably the case. It's not even Bryan Danielson's best match in a 24-hour period.
That's wild.
Yes, but it was a great match. So we start things off. The crowd is going nuts as they just stare at one another and are smiling. And the bell rings. And, dude, you have never heard these people just be so thankful to be on this planet in the same era as these two men who have chosen to be professional wrestlers. And Bryan Danielson, early on, like, he's doing all this little stuff. Like, they're... he's got him in a headlock and he's hitting him with these open hand palm strikes and evading Ospreay's kicks. And we just reach a stalemate as the crowd's going nuts here for their standoff. And then he gives Ospreay the middle finger after Ospreay catches his leg and they go into a chop battle. Ospreay does a springboard and Bryan Danielson kicks him right near the liver and down goes Ospreay, selling the body shot. And that's when Bryan Danielson immediately targets the liver with knees from the tie clinch right to the affected area. And Ospreay finally cuts off Danielson, sending him to the floor and manages the leap of faith as, I mean, this audience was pretty much at a 10 from start to finish of this match. We got the cattle mutilation. Then Danielson goes for a Rana off the top and Ospreay just seamlessly lands on his feet and comes back with a tiger driver. And Ospreay gets knocked off balance off the top and Danielson climbs to the top and he puts one arm under and then another underhook. And then you're wondering, oh my God, Bryan Danielson manages a tiger suplex off the top turnbuckle.
Crazy.
And this is like 15 minutes into this match.
It's such a crazy and rarely seen bump, requiring a ton of trust in somebody being able to, tilt you in the right angle so that you can land on hopefully not your head without the use of your arms to break your fall. Yeah, just crazy.
They manage to make their way to the edge of the apron, and this is where Ospreay hits the Os Cutter. And at this point, the crowd gets to their feet and chanting, "We're not worthy," which might be a first in terms of a chant at a wrestling show that I can recall. Ospreay leaps off the apron with the forearm as Bryce is tending to Danielson. And as Danielson beats the count in, he is nailed with a springboard dropkick. And then we see the Os Cutter caught coming down as Danielson goes for the label lock. It's blocked, so he transitions to the guillotine. And then, I love this, he goes and does La Mystica, fully getting into the label lock and is hyperextending the shoulder. And here is just like this little like influence of like his lucha trip over the last month, and where he did have, you know, the ape man with Mystico as well. Then we see a Dragon Rana by Danielson. So mixing in some lucha that I definitely think is not just a coincidence that he was like mixing in some of the stuff over the last month. And then ducks a hidden blade and hits the Busaiku knee for an amazing near fall at this point. So Danielson then goes to stomps. He's fish hooking Will Ospreay. Not allowed under the unified rules, but we're not the unified rules here in AEW. So Ospreay is hitting massive forearms inside of Danielson's guard. And you're almost thinking like, oh my God, are they going to do a stoppage finish? Because Danielson goes limp at one point from these forearms. Mm-hmm. But then he just fires back, locking on a triangle. The
commentary was trying to convey that it was him playing possum to get Ospreay off guard for the triangle. Yeah.
So Ospreay, to break out of the triangle, postures up to his feet and hits a Styles Clash to exit out of the triangle. So for all you black belts out there, I mean, you're getting some cheat codes here to get out of a triangle.
I don't know if the Gracies ever tried this, but you know, jiu-jitsu is always evolving. Yeah.
So then the two men get on all fours and they just like have to get in their requisite headbutts. And then these brutal slaps are delivered by Danielson and he hits the shoulder capture suplex, but Ospreay roars to his feet and lands a running elbow. And then in maybe the most incredible counter here, he goes for the Os Cutter and is hit with a picture perfect Busaiku in midair that looked amazing in the moment. And the replay made it look even better.
Might have been my favorite spot of the whole match.
I think it was mine. It just looked so great and you were not expecting it. And the height he got and landing it, like this could have looked bad. Just the timing was
outstanding.
It was impeccable.
And how on target it was too. Like I haven't seen the replay of it yet, but like it looked like it hit him right in the head.
He might have. And I'm sure they had these agreements of just like,
but
better.
It was like, but even if you intended on doing it, like how perfect do you have to time it in your own body and in your opponent's body in order to meet like that with both of you, like having to make these split second movements and decisions in that moment like that?
And then we go to the final sequence, and they just go to their corners, and I love this.
Oof.
And it's just like it's like the crashing of the bulls, basically.
It's where it's like a Texas, you know, Western shootout where like you walk to opposing sides, you know exactly what your opponent is about to do, but it's about who can draw fastest. In you know, it's kind of like a game of chicken. Pretty much.
Like, this was the pro wrestling equivalent of what we saw with Max Holloway and Justin Gaethje last weekend. In an MMA fight, you can't really go to your corners in the final 10 seconds and then just come at each other, yeah. But it was kind of the same spirit. And Ospreay removes the elbow pad, Danielson is getting ready, and they just run at one another, and it's the hidden blade that hits first. And he nails Danielson, underhooks him, and delivers the Storm Driver 93. And Bryce is screaming at Doc Sampson, and you just see Ospreay in the background, and he runs at Danielson with the match-ending hidden blade to pin Danielson at 32 minutes and 40 seconds in one of the most incredible matches you are ever going to see.
Yeah, yeah. There were already very unrealistic expectations for this match, and this match greatly, greatly exceeded them. You know, first of all, the atmosphere alone from the beginning of this match was unbelievable. St. Louis, I think, completely played their part in elevating this match to an even higher status than I think what its content alone dictated. But man, it's like, this is the type of match that I think will probably be studied for many years to come, you know, just simply for so many things, but especially the timing of these two and the design of some of these sequences. They told, first of all, like a great classic story of, you know, a high flyer versus a grappler, somebody who, you know, will nullify Ospreay's athleticism just by, you know, knowledge of technique and ground-based submissions. Then the later part of the match put a lot more emphasis than I was anticipating on their dueling charging finishers here in the Busaiku knee and the hidden blade, and that just allowed for so much like great storytelling and interesting scenes, you know, like that ending Western duel between the two of them. I just love that finish. It was so awesome. And at this point, you just kind of debate about where this match might rank, not just among the matches of the year, but among both men's entire careers, and we're talking incredible catalogs for the both of them.
This is among the best matches I've ever seen. I have no reservations in saying that. I don't think that's recency bias. I will guarantee you I will rewatch this at some point and feel the exact same way. And I think there were so many little things, especially on the side of Danielson, that you could just hyper focus on, and it's only going to enhance your viewing of this a second or third time. So Danielson in the post-match, he is down and he is selling like he can't move. He's just screaming, and Sampson is checking on him. The EMTs are in there checking on him. Ospreay is concerned. And I mean, the only way is that, I mean, we literally saw this at the ROH show a few weeks ago. Like, they did a similar tease of like with Billy Starks as well. And knowing that it's a Bryan Danielson, I don't feel there was anybody in this building that was concerned that this was like something had gone awry here. Mm-hmm. Just knowing, especially the Bryan Danielson style of selling. But I think it really got over the impact of the Tiger Driver like that much more. I actually wish Will had not used that move once since the Kenny Omega match.
Yeah.
And this was the set, because he's used that in pretty much all his matches. It's a setup.
Finishers. Yeah.
And I kind of wish like this was the first time he brought it out since Forbidden Door. But I mean, man, you're really
maybe to like an AEW exclusive viewer, like it still felt that special, because I guess you wouldn't have seen it on AEW TV until now.
Mm-hmm.
But I agree. And like I had no issues whatsoever. Like, you know, if we're talking about comfort level with a spot like this,
if anything, I kind of liked like watching this, and it was like you were I don't really like to watch wrestling with the idea that we're going to play with paralysis as a potential outcome.
Well, yeah, I mean, we talked about the Billy Starks one on our ROH review, and maybe being there live is kind of different, but like, because I could see this one on camera, like it looked like a very safe,
he took it very, as well as you can for that type of a maneuver.
Certainly compared to the Kenny one, this looked like a very safe Tiger driver. And for me, maybe I even hate saying this, but the drama wasn't there as much as a result. But I can get into it simply because I know that they're going to tell a bigger story from the spot. And I'm able to suspend my disbelief just, because I'm engaged for that reason. And at the end, I'm much happier seeing a move that is safe in order to tell a story versus a move that could legitimately put a man's health in danger.
Yeah. I think these two are going to wrap up match of the year. I hazard to say that in April, because we don't know what we will see later this year. I would state that if any two people are going to usurp this match, it's going to involve one of these two. And I think this is your 1-2 race for wrestler of the year as well. It's going to be these two, because as much as Ospreay feels like the foregone winner for 2024, Danielson, I mean, just this weekend, dude, watch that bunkhouse brawl if you have a chance. And the fact that he did that 24 hours before this, it's two of the greatest matches I've ever seen from someone on back-to-back nights. It's unreal.
Danielson is closing out his career with the best run of his entire career, at least when we're talking about in-ring content. But Will Ospreay is just on another level, man. He's just exceptional. I very well could involve Danielson and somebody else when we're talking at the end of the year, but I wouldn't really bet on one of those people not being Will Ospreay. He to me is the consistent part of the equation in all of these discussions. He's just so,
I would say, outside of some injury that sidelined him, I would say that is your
barring a Kenny Omega return and Omega Ospreay 3, which I think would be one of the only things that could threaten it. This might have wrapped it up, unless these two have their own rematch,
which is possible. Yeah. So an amazing, amazing match. One of the greatest you're going to see. I think if you order a pay-per-view and you have a match that is among the greatest you've ever seen, then I think that's there's thumbs up, and then there's another level for what this was. And Excalibur does state afterward that Danielson was upright and able to walk to the back with the assistance of the medical staff. So that was your update, as our cool down period was a ladder match between the Young Bucks and FTR. And I mean, 99% of the times you would dread the people that would have to follow a match like that. I had no concern that this was going to follow that last match in some way, shape, or form.
Yeah,
it was definitely tough, I think, for this crowd to come back after that last match they saw.
Certainly, yeah. But when you're looking up and down the card, I don't know if there is a match that stood a better chance of withstanding that this position than this match. We're talking about a hot, sort of legacy feud at this point between the Bucks and the FTR. We're talking about a ladder match that'll be full of spectacle, which I think would be a good palate cleanser for the type of drama that you had invested your crowd in prior. So I think to start off, it felt, in contrast to Ospreay versus Danielson, the crowd were trying to regain their energy a little bit. But by the end, I mean, it was a pretty good reception. Maybe not the reception that this match would have had on its own without following Ospreay and Danielson, but still a good one, I thought.
Yeah, I mean, these four killed each other in this match. I mean, listen, I really enjoyed this match. It was an unbelievable match. But if I never see any of these four in a ladder match again, I'm not going to be complaining either. They have done their tour of duties when it comes to ladder matches, especially the Young Bucks, that it feels almost as though it's they don't need to be doing ladder matches at this stage, is the stage of their career and what they're cutting short at this point. I just think that it's we have seen every conceivable version of a ladder match, especially from the Young Bucks.
In many ways, I agree with you. They're over enough that they don't need to do this stuff. At the same time, I think expectations continue to rise for what we expect out of pay-per-view level AEW, gimmick matches.
Well, I think Cash Wheeler had the decision. You know what? If this is where it ends, this match for my career, so be it. I'm gonna just go till the wheels fall off in this match. So early on, Dax. First of all, Dax gets a drop toe hold into the steps, and thus this man donated about 2 pints of blood to the city of St. Louis.
it was pretty significant. The only blade job on the show, but a pretty big one.
Yeah, I mean, he bled for 90% of this, 21 and a half minute match. And then we just saw all these creative utilizations of the ladder. They set one up between the apron and the timekeeper's table that would come into effect a little bit later on. Cash got crotched on this ladder and then hit with an EVP trigger as he was on the ladder. And then Cash battles back as Dax is just bleeding. So it was pretty much a handicap match while Dax was trying to regain consciousness. And they hit a Steinerizer as Dax gets back into the match. Dax places Matt into a sharpshooter, and then Cash puts the ladder on top of Matt, climbs, but then Nick super kicks Dax and climbs to knock Cash down. And this is when Cash dives at Matt, sending him off the apron through a table, and... Like, Matt almost overshot this thing. Like, he went down on, like, the edge of his ass going down on this table. And Cash just crashed to the floor. One of many Tope Suicidas by Cash Wheeler that I thought this guy had a death wish. He was going, like, a Darby Allin levels of speed on. And for a guy the size of Cash Wheeler, like, he's not a small man. He's like a fire hydrant that was just going at unbelievable speeds.
I wondered if, like, you know, there was part of their mentality in realizing that this was going to be a really tough spot following Danielson and Ospreay, and I wonder if they, like, went that much harder as a result.
Think about what these four had on their shoulders. Following that match, you've got a ladder match, which comes with its expectations, and you have these four in their rubber match that comes with it, or sorry, their fourth match that comes with its expectations. Like, yeah. The pressure is, like, we so kind of understate it at times. Like, these four were in, I would argue, the toughest spot of anyone on this card, including Danielson and Ospreay to a degree. I think, like, these four had to follow that.
Yeah, I wouldn't disagree. I would also put into contention the match after this one, because I think Swerve and Joe had to not only follow that, what is it, still, like, the memory of Danielson and Ospreay, they also had to follow this match.
Well... We continue. Update on Dax. He is still a faucet. Dax goes for a powerbomb on the edge, which Nick counters with a Rana, sending Dax off the apron through a table on the floor. All four recover and get onto the ladders. Matt ends up alone, so Dax is ripping at Matt, taking his shoe off, and yank him into a shatter machine. Nick responds with chair shots to everyone, and then Nick gets hit with the Power and Glory off the ladders by Dax and Cash. Nick then does a 450, putting Cash through a table, while Dax pile drives Matt through the ladder that's between the apron and the timekeeper's table, but the ladder, like, gives out on the edge before the pile driver. So Matt comes down and he's grabbing his head, and you're thinking this guy might have just, like, concussed himself, but appeared to be okay afterwards. But when they showed this replay, and, like, the ladder just came out from under them before the impact, and you were certainly worried about that one. Nick then springboards onto a ladder, sunset bomb to Dax, and this is when Cash pretty much pieces out from the match with this insane Tope Suicida, missing Nick and crashing through a table on the floor. Like, I can't do justice for the speed at which this man crashed through this table on the floor. And they link it to the Full Gear match, their first tag match in 2020, when FTR was in control of the match and Cash did a big high-flying spot that ended up costing them the match. And now he's, like, killed himself. And the crowd starts chanting, "Please be careful." Dax and Nick are on top. Nick gets knocked down, and it's a clear path to victory for Dax Harwood. He just needs to climb when a masked man runs into the ring and tips the ladder, and the announcers are calling it. It's a fan. A fan's run in, and the security grabs him. He unmasks, and it's Jack Perry, who gets a thunderous reaction, and Nick is looking surprised as he's on the ladder, climbs up, grabbing the titles at 21 minutes and 34 seconds. And it looks like we have the fourth member of the Elite, and they are off to the races for the Jack Perry return, and a run that's going to be heavily focused upon, and seeing what juice they get out of all the criticism that they received in the promotion of this match.
Yeah. again, this is not a spot on this card that I think anybody envied, but if anybody was going to live up to the task, it was these four with this style of match, and they completely delivered, I think, on our, again, very high expectations for a match type of this nature. They killed themselves here in order to try to win this crowd back and gave us a crazy blade job from Dax. So many dangerous moments involving ladders and tables, and it was definitely a scary one for a lot of people involved. Crazy dives from everybody, including Cash, but it ended up being a great match, you know? The type of match where, like, you almost, like, wonder if this was, like, on any other pay-per-view, how much better would the crowd have sounded? How much more would we be talking about it coming out of this event? But just the fact that it was put in this position and still garnered this type of reaction and that sort of spotlight for Jack Perry at the end of it, I think is to be definitely commended.
There's shows, man, you could have headlined with this mm-hmm. match. Like, it was, yep. Like, you could have made the argument to close with any of these final three matches. I think they were all at a level people would have accepted, but given how the ending was going to go, they made the right call. I think all four, they just worked super hard in this match. Like, it was a tremendous match. Like, following, like, an all-time match as well. So that takes us to the main event, Samoa Joe and Swerve Strickland for the AEW Championship, and Wei, being the resident aficionado, do you want to take us through the introduction, the entrance for Swerve Strickland?
Well, he came out dressed as some form of either Black Panther or Killmonger.
Killmonger?
Yes. Yeah, maybe more Killmonger than Black Panther.
This looked awesome. As soon as he walked out in this, I immediately said, he is not losing this match. And then Prince Nana puts Jimmy Rave's robe on top of him. And I was like, okay, there's not a prayer this guy is losing.
Well, did he win at Wembley?
Swerve? No, he got put in the coffin.
Because he wore the same thing. He wore it at Wembley, too.
The Killmonger thing and
he wore the Jimmy Rave robe.
The combo together. You couldn't...
Okay. Yeah.
So... the final match, it's got Jim Ross on the call with Excalibur and Nigel McGuinness. And it's like, for all this is following from the past, like, hour plus 90 minutes of this pay-per-view, it's not like this crowd was sitting on their hands at the start of this. Like, they seemed into it from the beginning, and it was almost like this arena sensed, like, we are going to see this title change. And I think this would have been such a flat ending if Swerve had lost at the end. But it was...
So they did also make mention that Stephon Smith was refereeing his, I believe they said, his first main event on pay-per-view.
Yes.
And, like, I think to me that already, like, telegraphed the significance of what I think they were trying to build here for the finish, with Swerve being the first Black AEW champion.
Which, I mean, they were mentioning throughout the match, like, that was his goal in this match. Joe does the walk-off and then puts Swerve through a desk with the Uranagi, or at least on top of the desk, and removes the padding on the floor, but gets met with a Fosbury flop from Swerve. They continue fighting on the floor, and Joe manages a power slam onto the exposed concrete, and Joe is in control, dominating Swerve until he goes for a strike, missing him and nailing the post. And this weakens the arm that Swerve would target throughout the rest of the match, including trying a short arm scissors, which Joe breaks with a buckle bomb. And Joe just places him on the turnbuckle, hits the muscle buster, and Swerve kicks out. And it was pretty much just going to, like, big moves after this. Joe grabs the title belt, but gets hit by the house call and a 450 splash onto the belt, then a Swerve stomp, and Joe kicks out. And Joe then goes to the eyes. Nana distracts as Swerve misses with a belt shot, and he's caught in the coquina clutch, and he's doing a great job just with his eyes and eyeing the rope, and he finally makes it and grabs the thumb of Joe to get out of the coquina clutch and turns and snaps the left arm of Joe that he's been working on. Swerve looks down at the belt and says, "Whose house?" and hits the house call, but Joe manages to kick out one more time. They fight on the turnbuckle, and Joe gets squeezed in the nose. Underrated tactic in a fight.
Has it been tried in the UFC?
Squeezing someone's nose.
People do, like, cover. Like,
they cover. Mouths. They cover so you can mess up your breathing. But actually squeezing the nose is not one that I've been, I have seen. Okay. And he then leaps over Joe and then, like, comes back and power bombs him. And then He just climbs to the top. He looks up to the sky, hits the swerve stomp, and just sits on top of Joe, covers the leg, and gets the pin in 18 minutes. And this crowd just got to their feet really in advance of the swerve stomp. It was a really great visual they had where he would just let it sink in before he hit the stomp. And what I really liked, too, is that they kept, like, we didn't immediately just have to get off the air. We got to see the post-match celebration, and he seemed like he was just overwhelmed by the moment. He was embracing, like, all the fans and probably friends at ringside, and it was just a great moment. It capped off what I thought was an amazing show and was the right finish for this show. It just felt like this was definitely the timing. As much as we looked at, you know, there was no Hangman Page involved in this. There was nothing in terms of run-ins or anything like that. And I think they got it right.
Oh, without a doubt. Yeah. I mean, so first of all, I thought it was a very good match. You know, I thought this was like some of the best I've seen Samoa Joe and some of the most meanest and most powerful I've seen Samoa Joe. So, you know, I think he also had a great run. But, you know, it is time for Swerve, especially when you have so many other people waiting that are ready for that spot as well, like a Will Ospreay that's coming up. But Swerve has, I think, you know, been deserving of this coronation for quite a while. And I feel like there's an argument to be made that he was maybe at his hottest a couple months back, you know, coming off of like the Hangman Page match and maybe the Continental Classic as well. But this still felt like a very significant moment. I do feel like while it was a very good match, I do think it was overshadowed in several ways. It was overshadowed by some of the spectacle of the match prior to this. You had a big blade job. You had a lot of weapons in the match prior to it. It was overshadowed in, I would say, performance by Danielson and Ospreay. And it was overshadowed in build by CM Punk and Jack Perry in the lead up to this match. So I feel like this moment of Swerve winning this first championship could have felt bigger to me. But ultimately, it's all about how you book a champion beyond this that is going to kind of leave that lasting legacy. And they've started, and I'm looking forward to seeing how much bigger they can make Swerve at this point coming out of it.
Yeah, I thought it was, you know, given the spot, yeah, it was not at the level of the prior two matches. I don't know how many matches you've seen in the last 5 years that would be at the level of, you know, especially the Ospreay Danielson match. But I thought like it held its plates in the main event. And I think it was a big like championship level reaction when he won and treated like a big deal. And now it's, you know, like we talk with Cody now, it's like you've got the title and now is that position. Now you are the champion and being focused upon. And, you know, and they have to get a challenger ready for next month. So you can either, you could do the Joe rematch. I personally would want to get to the next Page Hangman match again with Swerve. I mean, I think that's a great direction to go for Double or Nothing if you want to go that way, unless they have another person in mind.
Yeah. AEW, I think, really needed, you know, this show to be an all-timer in order to wipe away a lot of the controversial PR. I'm not even going to say negative, but controversial PR that might have come out over recent months. Certainly, maybe to counter some of the very positive reception to one of the WWE's most successful months in its entire history. AEW getting what I'm going to anticipate to be maybe one of the best receptions to any pay-per-view that they've ever put on, a contender certainly for pay-per-view of the year, is exactly the type of press that they need right now.
Yeah, it was an excellent, excellent show, I think, with a match that I'm hard-pressed to imagine will get topped this year for match of the year. And if it does, that's going to be one of the greatest matches you'll ever see later this year if that happens. So, yeah, I just thought this was an excellent show overall, and it came in with huge expectations. Not like this was some sleeper that just hit you out of nowhere that everyone just delivered. It came in, this card looked really deep and then some in terms of what it came back and delivered with.
So now this great response, and I'm going to assume overwhelmingly positive response to the pay-per-view, how do you ensure that the people who haven't been watching continue to tune into AEW and jump on for the next one, and especially maybe jump on to your weekly television?
Listen, I always think that when you come off of a pay-per-view, it's very important to not just have sole focus on your next pay-per-view and boom, we're selling you on the next show. I think part of it is if you missed this show, this was a really big night in AEW's history that you missed. And this is why you missed it. And this is one of the greatest matches of all time. And if like you build a big segment for Swerve on Wednesday, and maybe you even get like reactions from some of the wrestlers to Danielson and Ospreay, like this was one of the greatest matches of all time. And you promote it like that and build it. And yeah, maybe a 3-minute video package recapping the match and getting reaction from peers. Okay,
from
maybe
the public. You know, this is your time to just kind of blow up all the Twitter response. Fucking show the cage match rating, whatever. Like show Dave Meltzer's rating that I'm sure.
You know how many people were probably leaving the Chaffetz Arena doing the Nana dance tonight and just losing their minds for Swerve. That like it's all this stuff that I just you put on these great shows. That's the hard part. Now just pat yourselves on the back and promote it. It's like, this is what you're missing. You will not see a match like this or a pay-per-view like this anywhere. And you can say that and no one is going to call you on that.
Agreed. Yeah.
So there you go. That was Dynasty. And we will now shift over. If you want to get in a super chat, you're welcome to do so. And we have pieces of feedback on the forum. So again, we're not going to be able to get the calls tonight because it is a late one, but we will manage to get some feedback in here.
Let's start with the forum.
Okay. We're going to go to Benjamin. Good Lord, that Ospreay-Danielson match was so good. I hope he's okay. That was a scary finish. Each match was solid, except the pre-show. Jericho and Hook had some scary moments in it. Jericho nearly getting suplexed into steel steps being one. Yeah, he took, I mean, first of all, like the guy took an immense amount of suplexes in this match. And the one he's talking about was on the floor where they pointed it out how close he came to the edge of the stairs as well, but did avoid it. What an amazing show, though. Glad Willow is finally getting a title. I hope it's not a short or meaningless run. Swerve as the new champ. Long may he reign.
We go up next to Mark, who says, Bell to Bell, one of AEW's strongest pay-per-views ever. Although I feel like we say that every month. Extremely happy for Swerve and seeing him climb the ranks of the company to becoming the world champion. Hopefully, we could see him getting a good run and establishing him with some solid heel opponents. Ospreay versus Danielson was everything we hoped for and more. The ladder match was a painful in the best way watch. I do feel like Perry felt like a star the moment the mask came off, and I absolutely feel like airing the CM Punk footage was responsible for that. Obviously, it has made for some unbearable discourse, but I can't see Perry's return having the same impact without it. Even the low point of the show, the Jericho Hook match, was still a passable plunder brawl. Anyway, congratulations on the climb today and raising what you did. Enjoy a good night's sleep.
I think AEW, at the end of the day, I think they got what they wanted out of the whole security footage thing. But I mean, it would be impossible not to notice like how much it was downplayed afterward too, like from the video, like it was mentioned in passing in the video package and such. And I mean, maybe they felt it was a net positive overall. I don't know if you're getting all that different of a reaction to Jack Perry returning after all these months with or without the footage. It is noticeable, and it's not like it's a big chant, but it is noticeable, like some of these CM Punk chants that are continuing. They happened on Saturday, and maybe they're gone now, but Jack Perry will encourage those that kind of reaction from fans that want to chant for CM Punk, and whether they want that or not.
And you know what I feel might discourage those chants? A show like this with quality wrestling like this, to me, that's all you ever needed to focus on. You know, all like, should you really be exchanging the possibility of like whatever all that toxic discourse in order to promote Jack Perry, one guy? Maybe to Tony Khan it makes sense, but to me it doesn't. Especially when you have an alternative way to promote your company in the form of amazing wrestling and amazing shows like this.
What would be the better tagline? AEW, where the best wrestle, or AEW, embrace the grind?
What's that from?
That was the Paul Levesque line.
Embrace the grind?
With Will Ospreay.
Oh, really? I guess we're the best wrestle.
Okay. Let's go to Steve Grows Weed. I agree that Jericho needs a TV break, but chanting please retire seems shitty. The fact that we live in a world where we got a 420 match on Rampage last night warms my heart. Do you think having so many epic matches in front of the main event hurt the match? It felt like they lost the crowd for a minute there, but got them by the end. All in all, a great way to cap off a holiday weekend. Listen, when you're in the championship match in AEW, that's what you've got to follow. Like, you have to follow the deepest roster that, I mean, this is among the deepest rosters in the history of wrestling promotions, certainly of any with national television in this country. Or the U.S., I should say. But I didn't think that Swerve and Joe was, you know, I thought they did really well in the main event
slot. I actually felt like Swerve and Joe had the toughest spot, you know, because they didn't have like, you know, blood nor like ladders and tables to rely on to maybe get that reaction. They had to follow that along with Danielson and Ospreay. So considering
you guys
all of
that, get to use the belt as a foreign object.
Yeah. Considering all of that, I think they did a great job. But like, you're going to run into issues like this, you know, on a wrestling show. Like, it makes no sense to
Swerve works with Ospreay, you are always going to have an Ospreay match to follow on these pay-per-views,
and an Okada match, you know, like that was pretty incredible too, that we're not even like talking about.
Dude, my article on Friday, I listed all the people that they didn't have available for this show, and it's crazy.
It's amazing.
Like, Moxley was don't have Kenny Omega, they didn't have Takeshita, they didn't have Adam
Claudio.
Cole, MJF's out, like Darby Allin wasn't on this show. It's like
can you imagine what Wembley Stadium is going to look like when hopefully all those names are back? You know, it's gonna be insane. Gonna be crazy. Sam Banks sends a super chat here for $5, who says, I was at the show tonight, and Will versus Daniel Bryan, Bryan Danielson, was one of, if not the best crowds I've ever been a part of. Certainly sounded that way, Sam, so consider yourself very lucky to have been there. All right, let's go up next to Cody from Maine, who says, a month and a half ago, I felt like I saw with my own eyes the match of the year at Revolution with Ospreay versus Takeshita. Tonight, I know I watched the match of the year between Ospreay and Danielson, unfortunately from the comfort of my living room. While they had to kill each other in the tag title match to get the exhausted fans invested, I'm glad that match was placed where it was. It would have been easy to throw any other match out there and let it die a death. Overall, AEW once again delivers on pay-per-view. Shout out to YouTube for a flawless stream as well. Happy to have options other than BR Live.
Oh, well, that's good. And that's a big part of how well this show does. Mm-hmm. I mean, no one's expecting this to do Revolution level numbers, where you had Sting's retirement.
Although, like, how much word of mouth might be responsible for replays?
You know? Listen, this is the show that is going to prove, like, it's not like there was one match on this card that had like the appeal of, say, a Sting retirement. But in terms of a wrestling show, I mean, this was as can't miss as a card looks on paper, and was going to be our first result of the, like, you know, you had Okada and Ospreay, two of your three big signings on this show. And just how much the AEW base is at for a show of this level, and just opening it up to other distributors too. Like, does that make a difference with the streaming numbers beyond just BR Live in the States? Like, they made it a whole lot easier for you if you're a US streamer, and not relying on BR Live.
Mm-hmm. First here, John, $10 super chat just coming in here from Jason Hagholm, who says, AEW with another tremendous pay-per-view. My question is, this pay-per-view, as good press, Is this pay-per-view good press, but how big is the Forbes piece putting AEW at number 3 in terms of most valuable combat sports promotions?
Yes, this was the Forbes article that listed them at like a $2 billion valuation. I would like to know how they kind of arrive at that figure, but I mean, it's kind of like how much stake you want to put in that valuation. If people look at that and that's what they take as the valuation of AEW, it's a win for them to be listed at that. But I looked at that list and just like what one championship is listed at and what PFL is listed at. And I can't fathom anyone spending that amount of money to buy any of those companies. And who would buy an AEW for $2 billion? Like, maybe there's somebody out there.
Do you at least agree with the ranking, placing it just under, well, in terms of combat sports properties, UFC and WWE?
I would put AEW above any non-UFC MMA organizations, yes. Very comfortably. Yeah. Right. So, yeah, it was like, listen, it's ultimately, if it's good press for them to be, you know, assigned, you know, such a ranking and have that valuation, whether whether you believe that's how much the company is worth or not.
Thank you very much, Jason, for that super chat.
We go to Brian from New Jersey. Definite thumbs up show for me. To keep things short, I thought the main event delivered and had the right outcome. Ospreay and Danielson tore the roof off the arena and had a unique post-match to hopefully shape the weeks ahead. And the ladder match got bowling shoe ugly at times. I wouldn't say bowling shoe ugly, but
bowling shoe ugly would suggest like a lot of botches. And I mean, there were moments of concern, but I didn't
there
really
were a lot of moments of concern
botches
in that match.
Yeah, well, all right, thank you. Let's go to Jordan from the Bronx, who says, excellent pay-per-view. Ospreay Danielson was unreal. I've noticed in Danielson matches that when he's visibly hurt, he's selling. When he's not hurt at all, he's probably hurt for real. The man wrestled with an eye patch and sold a seizure to cover up a broken arm. Also, Ospreay has said in promos building this match that his killer move is the Tiger Driver 91. My hope is that everything in that match went as planned and that Danielson is okay. Swerve and Willow are champions. A year ago, I couldn't fathom either of them being here, but here we are and it's glorious. I know that they have Ospreay and Mercedes respectively threatening their runs to be short and transitional. Here's hoping for impactful reigns. Shout out to the NWA podcast. Wrestling is for naysayers. Jericho with the FTW belt leads me to believe that they're going to legitimize the title. Hopefully Hook moves up the card and onto someone else. The feud didn't do it for me, and like the crowd, I'm very Jericho'd out. I wonder what he means by Jericho with the FTW belt leads me to believe they're going to legitimize the title.
Yeah, if it's a joke title at this point, then I don't know what Hook has done with that title for all this time. I think it's not so much of a, I just look at it as a meaningless title.
Meaningless, yeah. What's the only, it's a hardcore rules title, but like nobody seems to want it.
Yeah.
Jericho didn't seem to want it. He never conveyed that.
That it did not seem to be his main objective. It's teaching him a lesson. And the last word goes to Muggin. I just saw Ospreay Danielson again before hopping on the forum. It was everything was advertised to be and then some. It was a Tokyo Dome level match that'll be a crown jewel in both men's catalogs. The finish felt like the end of an anime fight, ending about who was going to shoot first. I was in awe. Too bad the Bucks and FTR were put in a tough spot to follow that instant classic. Dynasty was a good night for black wrestling with Willow and Swerve winning the gold.
Yes, it was. Thank you all you guys for your feedback here at forum.postwrestling.com. We allow all of our Post Wrestling Cafe patrons to chime in with their thoughts on all of the shows that we review here. And of course, the best way to support the channel is through postwrestlingcafe.com, where you can get a bunch of bonus shows every single week as well.
Yes, $6 a month gets you access to the Post Wrestling Cafe, which comes with multiple bonus shows per week, including Rewind to SmackDown every Friday night. We're live and take calls on Fridays, Saturday with Collision Course, and we have Rewind Away that is coming up this week. If you have never experienced Hustle, get ready as we go back to May of 2004, where we are going to see Kevin Nash and Scott Hall take on Shinya Hashimoto and Naoya Ogawa. In addition to Toshiaki Kawada against Mick Foley, could you ask for anything more?
Absolutely not. Yeah, I'm very curious to dive into my first Hustle experience.
Well, that is coming up this Thursday, again, on the Post Wrestling Cafe. We also have audio updates that come out for Double Double and Espresso patrons. Today, actually, for all members of the cafe, I did do a quick review of the Impact Rebellion show. So that is up there for all members of the cafe going through Saturday's pay-per-view. So that's going to bring everything to a close. We are back Monday night following Raw, and we will be chatting about a new Raw Women's Champion and everything else that is going down on Monday's edition of Raw from Columbus, Ohio. So thanks to everyone for tuning in tonight, and that caps off our Dynasty review.